Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Who's the Jack in Jack-O-Lantern?
Which witch is which between a warlock and a witch?
What's the where in Werewolf?
Find out now in this haunted Halloween edition of Words Unraveled. Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Zafaris, author of the book Words from Hell, which is pertinent to this episode because we are howling at the moon on this ghastly, ghoulish episode.
Yes, we are haunting your feeds with our etymology of the unexplained, of the strange, of the terrifying, of the monstrous.
Proper creepy stuff.
It's going to be super, super creepy.
So scary.
We should start with, given the time of year that it is, we should start with Halloween. I think people have an idea of where this comes from, but they maybe don't know ultimately the origins of the festival. So let's go into that first, Jess.
Most people know that Halloween is short for All Hallows' Eve, but there is more to it than that. The first recorded spelling is basically All Hallow Even, and it's Scottish, and so is the shortening Halloween.
And that's why we sometimes spell it with the apostrophe. Do they do that much in the States? We do that a lot in England. We spell it with an apostrophe between the two E's.
Only if we're trying to be obnoxiously historical about it.
Right. Okay.
Generally speaking, it is
Thanks.
Just Halloween. But of course, that apostrophe like removes the V in even or evening, so to speak.
It's the eve of All Saints Day, the celebration on the 1st of November, which is a Christian festival. But the origins of Halloween aren't Christian, are they?
Right. Okay. So All Saints Day was when Pope Gregory III expanded the previously existing Martyrs' Day to celebrate All Saints. So I guess it does have a connection to death already, albeit one that's a little less morbid. But before it turned into All Hallows' Day Eve, the last night of the old Celtic calendar year was called either Old Year's Night or in Irish, Samhain. And the idea here, it means summer's end, but this night was the celebration of the boundary between the worlds of the living and the dead, when that boundary became more permeable. So you would light bonfires, literally bone fires. You would make sacrifices. You might wear costumes made out of animal skins, things like that. And then the Romans rolled in and added a couple of their own traditions to the mix. So it has elements of Feralia, which honored the spirits of the dead, and celebrations honoring Pomona, the goddess of fruit and trees, who especially liked apples and apparently bobbing for them.
Is that really where that comes from?
Evidently.
Oh, bobbing for apples. It's really difficult, actually.
It is.
It's just being really difficult. And you're sort of forcing it with your nose against the side of the bucket. And
just waterboard yourself for an apple.
I don't even want an apple. If it's not covered in candy, I don't want an apple. Anyway.
I'm particularly partial to apples. By the way, there is a fantastic book. If you're in a Halloween mood and you're looking for a really good book and you like apples and creepy culty stuff, I highly recommend Chuck Wendig's Black River Orchard. It's very good. It's very creepy. and it's very fun.
Jess is too modest to say that also her own book, if you're in a Halloweeny mood, is a very good one to read as well. Words from Hell by Jess Zafaris. Now out in paperback, actually. This hardback's very nice, but that in paperback now, with a Halloweeny colour scheme.
That's right. It has that black background. Mm. Also, I don't think I've ever noted on this show before that there are hidden objects in the frame around the cover. So I challenge you to find them. I believe there are six, but some of them are repeating.
Yeah. And some of them will surprise you, I'll tell you that much.
Yes. One of them is quite naughty.
It's true. There's some very naughty business going on in there, but it's all very interesting, and I really enjoy it. I never have it too far away when I'm embarking on an etymological journey. Where were we? Halloween bobbing for apples.
There's another gourd associated with Halloween.
Oh, no. What is it? Is it a vegetable?
It is. Well, I mean, it is a gourd.
Which is a vegetable.
Maybe. They've got the fruit inside, so they might be fruits.
Hello, it's Rob here with a spooky clarification. A gourd is a fruit. It's a hard-shelled fruit. I was wrong.
Back to the podcast.
We already did this on our other episode. I don't know whether a pumpkin is a fruit, but let's talk about pumpkins and jack-o'-lanterns, because we've got some fun like lore here, right? Are jack-o'-lanterns a thing that come up as frequently where you are currently? Like, do you see them as frequently in Halloween decorations? Is Halloween even something that people care about as much in Germany?
In Germany, not as much, but it's getting bigger. Back in Britain, it was pretty big, not as big as I understand it being in the United States, but I remember pretty much at every Halloween since my childhood carving what we do not call a jack-o'-lantern. We just call it a pumpkin, right? We don't use this term jack-o'-lantern. That's US English only, really, even though it's of Irish origin.
It predates America.
Yeah. So who's Jack then?
Right. Okay. So Jack, in many cases, anytime you see Jack in like an in any kind of expression, it's usually a generic name for any old guy, kind of in the same way we use average Joe or guy today. But Jack has a lot of stories. Often Jack is a trickster character or a motif that shows up in stories. So there's a folk tale about Jack of the Lantern. It's not the actual source of this word because the story came after the name, but it's a cool story. Jack was this trickster protagonist, in this case called Stingy Jack. He was a drunkard. he was a pretty nasty fellow. And so Satan overhears Jack bragging about his evil deeds and tells him he's come to make Jack pay the price. And Jack begs Satan to let him have one last night at the tavern before being dragged off to hell. And Satan's like, sure, whatever. So after a night of heavy drinking, Jack suggests that Satan transform himself into a coin so he can pay off the tab. And Satan does this because apparently he's very stupid. and so Jack puts the coin in his pocket where he kept a cross, which traps Satan in the coin. He promises to release Satan if he gives Jack an additional 10 years of life before he has to get dragged to hell. And of course, Satan has no choice because he's stuck in a pocket with a cross. So he agrees. So 10 years later, Satan comes back calling on Jack. Jack is underneath an apple tree. He begs him to enjoy one last apple. Again, Satan doesn't learn anything ever. So Satan climbs the tree. Jack comes prepared with a cross. He puts it at the base of the tree, trapping Satan again. He makes Satan promise that he will never go to hell. He's stuck again in this tree.
Now, you have to be careful with wishes, don't you?
Right. Eventually, when he does die, his soul isn't pure enough to make it into heaven, so he gets sent back down to earth for all eternity. Satan comes to mock poor Jack, who's alone on a dark night and has no light to find his way, and Satan tosses him a burning coal, which he puts inside a carved turnip to make a lantern. And some say he still roams the land to this day looking for a resting place.
Indeed, and the first jack-o'-lanterns, the first carved vegetables, were turnips in England, and or Swedes as well.
Pumpkins are native to the Americas.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you would just carve such a sad figure yourself if you were to be seen carrying a a turnip with a with a tea light inside it.
Turnip jack-o'-lanterns look scarier to me, honestly.
Yeah, perhaps.
But also, jack-o'-lantern, before it was a name for a carved vegetable, was also a word for like a will-o'-the-wisp. It means more or less the same thing. Will is another generic man's name, and a wisp was a bundle of straw used as a torch. So a will-o'-the-wisp is also like something that lurks off of the road and looks like a person carrying a lamp while you're lost at night.
A jack-o'-lantern could also just be someone who carries a lantern, whose job is to carry a lantern. The O in there, you assume it's of, but actually it could mean any number of different prepositions. So it could be Jack in the lantern. It could be Jack of the lantern. Yeah, it could be, it's had many different meanings, but it's kind of just settled on that one of the carved pumpkin idea based upon Stingy Jack.
Right, because we also don't need people, you know, standing on the road ahead of a town to make sure that people can find their way anymore.
So Halloween is a festival to celebrate the evening before another festival. But did you know that there has also been a festival to celebrate the eve of Halloween?
What's that?
It was something of a moral panic, actually, in the United States in the like 50s and 60s. Briefly, there was a fashion for something called Mischief Night.
Oh, yeah. I have heard of this.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And it was essentially people going out and creating absolute chaos on the night before Halloween. So on October the 30th, and the moral panic surrounded the idea that somehow Halloween was being defiled by this bad behavior, as if Halloween itself wasn't in any way associated with malpractice.
Right.
We had those in the UK as well. That was very much an American thing, but there was a Mischief Night in Britain as well. But that was on November the 4th, which is the day before our bonfire night, the night where we mark the failed attempts to blow up the Houses of Parliament by Guy Fawkes and his crew.
We should talk about that on another episode, by the way, how the word guy is basically in every instance is from Guy Fawkes.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? Yeah, the guy you would put on a bonfire, a bone fire. Yeah, it all comes from Guy Fawkes. And what you would do on the Mischief Night before Bonfire Night, by the way, which is another name for it, is basically you would steal your neighbor's belongings and put them on the fire.
Great.
For the next day.
Great. That sounds healthy.
Yeah. That one goes back a bit further than the American Mischief Night. But actually, if you look back through history, there have been various Mischief Nights. And yeah, none of them end well.
I think the spirit of it is a bit more wholesome now. More like children showing up at your door dressed as monsters to, you know, scare you, so to speak.
Have you ever been tricked?
I don't know that I have. Most of my Halloween celebrations have been fairly wholesome, witchy themed and costume oriented with lots of food and sugar.
Delicious and delightful and hyperactive rendering. Witchy, you say. Were you always a witch?
Not always. I have been any number of things. I was sushi one time.
What do you mean you were sushi?
I was dressed up as a sushi roll.
How's that scary?
I believe it's not necessarily supposed to be scary. You can be
like a high salmonella or E. coli. I can talk. I once went as a duvet.
Did you?
And my mum wouldn't let me cut holes in the sheet. So I just, okay, well, I guess I'm just a duvet then.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
What is your like favorite costume you've ever been?
I once went as, this is when I was at university, I went as Towel Man because I didn't have any money left after the early weeks of the university term. I didn't have any money left to buy a costume, but I did have a lot of different towels. So I sort of made myself a kind of towel-y tunic. I did cut some eye holes in a tea towel and made a kind of hero's mask. I had a beach towel as a cape, and I was Towel Man for a night, moving around incognito, ensuring everyone was dry at all times.
You took the advice of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy very literally, and therefore you're ready to explore the universe because you always have to have your towel, right?
Indeed.
Very nice.
Tell us about witches then.
All right.
Because you brought them up and you like witches.
I do like witches. I am a witchy bitch. Like that's very accurate from my aesthetic.
I definitely wouldn't have called you that. Go ahead.
So the original word for a woman who practices sorcery or witchcraft was spelled W-I-C-C-E, pronounced witcha. And it was a feminine form of witcha, which was, I'm probably going to butcher that a little bit, but that original word, which became the modernized word Wicca, was a word for a male witch, actually. At the time, witch wasn't specifically gendered. We think of witches as being female now, but it was sort of a non-gendered word for any male or female practitioner of sorcery until like the 1600s, when it became more associated with women, and male witches came to be referred to as he witches or men witches.
Yes, and that's how you know. That's the only way we know that at that point it started to apply more specifically to women.
Also, there were several different types of witches. What we might call a witch now is just one type of magical woman. There was also a Galdridge, someone who practices incantations or necromancy, a Skinlacca, which calls upon phantoms and spirits, and a Lubestra, who works with drugs, potions, poisons, and charms. So different kinds of witchiness.
Or manner of witchcraft. The idea was that one who was a witch, man or woman, had somehow reached some kind of agreement with the devil to have these powers, whether or not they were using the powers for good or for bad. So therefore, witchcraft was evil, no matter what your intention was, because it required you, by its very nature, to have struck some sort of devil's bargain.
Right. To call someone a wicked witch is redundant. It's more or less like calling someone a witchy witch, because The word wicked itself is an adjective variation of the Old English word for a witch.
Yeah. And we alluded to it already, but the modern pagan belief system of Wicca is directly from that Old English word meaning witch.
And it is very modern. Like that word for a belief system was coined in the 20th century. So whenever I talk about this, the question that I get when I say that like a male witch was called a he witch or a man witch, everyone's like, what about warlocks, right?
What about warlocks?
Right, well, exactly. Well, warlock was not the correspondent to a witch back in the day. Warlocks have nothing to do with war or with locks. It didn't mean anything to do necessarily with magic. The components means like traitor, liar, or enemy. The first element meant faith, fidelity, agreement, or covenant. And then the second element is from the Old English word for lying. So someone who's an oath breaker, essentially, is what a warlock was.
Okay. The Old English word for lying.
Literally means word liar, basically, or a deceiver.
I guess our word lie probably comes from that same word, right? Because I'm thinking about other Germanic words for lie, which are along the lines of sort of Luger or something like that.
Yeah, exactly that. Mm-hmm. We got from Oathbreaker to warlocks as like magical people because warloga was used to describe the devil when Christianity started blending with previous ideas around like witchcraft.
I also read that someone who was using magical powers for good or had sort of supernatural abilities that were positive and not associated with witchcraft was just known as being wise. There's this interesting, I don't want to say conflation or confusion, but association between knowledge and magic as if they're kind of the same thing. You know, they're not so far apart from one another to know an awful lot. I could kind of get on board with that idea. It's bizarre to think that some people possess more knowledge, more intelligence than others, right? And if that can vary, then maybe supernatural powers can vary as well.
Well, I mean, think about it. Science looks a lot like magic until you know the functions behind it. And my favorite Terry Pratchett quote is, it doesn't stop being magic just because you know how it works. So you get to experience the same kind of wonder if you look at science as if it has the same capacity as magic. So I see the logic.
While we're talking about magic and witchcraft, because whenever I think of witches, I think of one film, and that's Hocus Pocus. And I've been looking at where the term Hocus Pocus comes from.
It's so silly.
Yeah, well, yes, it is. It's many varieties of silly. Although it doesn't begin with magic as such. It begins with jugglers. In fact, a Hocus Pocus was a way to refer to a juggler. But that was because it was a sort of incantation or chant that they would say as they delivered a performance, as they performed some sort of trick. And as it looks, it is a kind of mock Latin.
Yeah, it's silly pseudo-Latin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although the Hocus Pocus itself is a sort of mockery of the mock Latin itself. It's a shortening of it. I found loads of quotes about this, Jess, that said different mock Latin terms were the origin of Hocus Pocus. Can I read you one or two of them?
Yeah, please.
So there's a quote from 1655, right, from a publication called Candle in Dark, and it says, "I will speak of one man that went about in King James's time, who called himself the King's Majesty's most excellent Hocus Pocus, and so was called because that at the playing of every trick, he used to say, Hocus Pocus tontus talontus vade celeretia jubio, a dark composure of words to blind the eyes of the beholder to make his trick pass the more currently without discovery." I think currently in that sense means the more sort of aware at that moment. But then there's another quote that's only 40 years older, there or thereabouts, 1694-ish. It says, "In all probability, those common juggling words of Hocus Pocus are nothing else but a corruption of hoc est corpus by way of ridiculous imitation of the priests of the Church of Rome in their trick of transubstantiation." That is throwing some serious shade at the Roman Catholics there.
Hoc est corpus means this is my body, or hoc est corpus meum means this is my body.
That's actual Latin. I hadn't actually picked up on that. And then I saw another one that said that it came from Hax Pax Max Deus Adimax, which is, as far as I can tell, gibberish.
That makes sense.
But it's likely that the word hoax actually comes from Hocus Pocus.
Comes from Hocus Pocus. Isn't that cool?
Yeah, oh, really good.
I love that. We should do like hoaxes sometime, because there's some funny stories around like the hoaxes that made it confusing to determine exactly where like cocktail as a word comes from. A couple other things. Very like H.L. Mencken stuff.
I have some information on some lexicographical hoaxes that we could go into right now, because they're known as ghost words. Are you aware of these?
Yes, I just made a video about these recently.
Ah, okay. Well, we can work on this one together then. But ghost words are words that make it into the dictionary despite having never existed as words. And that can be for various reasons. It can be a mistake by the lexicographer, or in the case of one, a deliberate insertion to, so you know how map makers will sometimes put a place in just to kind of protect them from people copying them, so they'll be able to know if someone's copied their map because it will have this made up place. Well, dictionary makers have been known to do something sort of similar in the past to make sure that if anyone's copying their sort of word hoard, then they'll know about it because this word that doesn't really exist will be in there. But there's a really good tale of one from the 2005 second edition of the New Oxford American Dictionary. Now, word got out that in that dictionary, in the E section, there was a word that did not really exist, but they waited to tell anyone what that word actually was. For example, these are words that were genuinely in there, electrofish or eurocreep, which are words. Anyway, it transpired eventually that it was a word that was described as a willful avoidance of one's official responsibilities, which is precisely what the lexicographer was guilty of. And that word was esquivalience.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, I like that. But other ones have been put in there by accident. My favorite one, Jess, is dored.
Oh, of course. So yeah, my understanding, like one of the distinctions that people sometimes make, yes, all ghost words, but sometimes people will distinguish ghost words as being unintentional additions to the dictionary versus Mount Weasels, named after the fictional Virginia Mount Weasel, as a fictitious entry that was intentionally put in place for those like copyright reasons or for other reasons. There's another example where the U.S. Army surveyed soldiers about their preferred foods, and to make sure that people were paying attention or like to figure out whether the data was good, they included dishes called Funistrata, Braised Trache, and Buttered Ermal, which are not foods at all. And people selected them as preferred over foods like lima beans and eggplant.
That's funny. Well, just because it sounds exotic. Although I'll do that on some menus, you know, if I'm in some
like, sounds cool.
Well, that sounds interesting. I don't know what that is. I think I'll have some of that.
Funistrata is now the name of a couple of restaurants that's like based on that too, which is fun. Anyway, we were talking about dored, which is an accidental ghost word. And what does dored mean?
Well, I mean, it was listed. So this is D-O-R-D, and it was listed as density in physics or chemistry, but no trace of this word could be found anywhere until it became apparent that the lexicographer had, well, actually it was the typesetter. So the people that had composed the dictionary got it right, but the person who'd actually got around to printing it had got it wrong. And they had neglected to put the spaces either side of the word or in the middle of it. So it should be capital D or lowercase d, density in chemistry or physics.
So the way I heard this happening, or the way I've dug into this a little bit, so this is the Merriam-Webster dictionary, the predecessor to it. This was GNC Merriam Company, and their chemistry editor was Austin M. Patterson. He prepares this little slip, like when you want to add something to the dictionary, the process is you put it on a little slip and you give it to the typesetters. Apparently the slip was lost and then retyped. And you would monospace the first letter, the head word in the definition. So D or lowercase d, like capital D or lowercase d contains density, might look like dord rather than D or D. It took like a decade or so to actually remove it.
Yeah, I would say it was 5 years before they spotted it or something like that.
But it continued in some print runs for like another like 5 years after that too.
That's great. Dord. I'm kind of disappointed, to be honest. I want to be a Dord.
One of my favorite ghost words has to do with the Book of St. Albans, which we've talked about before. It has our animal collectives, like a dazzle of zebras, a pride of lions, a melody of harpers, and other things like that, not just animals. But one of them is the word, a ghost word is the word theming, because it was misread as it was a misreading of the word business in the phrase "a business of ferrets" in the Book of St. Albans. It was like a game of bad handwriting telephone, because it was interpreted as like busyness or fezziness, and then it was translated to theming eventually.
And it is written in a completely incomprehensible way. You look at that word and you don't get business from it at all. I'm amazed that we've ever concluded that is what it is. I will say, when you first said theming, I thought, oh, it's going to be seeming. It's going to be one of those long S confusions, you know, where there's that letter that we don't use very much anymore.
But no, it's worse than that.
Yeah. But that has given rise to a ghost word, because Samuel Johnson included in his eminent dictionary the word...
A theming of ferrets. Mm.
No, he included the word foop. F-O-U-P-E, and he defined it as to drive with a sudden impetuosity. But what the word actually was soup, and it was a dialect word equivalent to swoop.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. You really got to watch those long S's. Oh, boy.
I feel like we should use foop for something, though.
Yeah, I know. I want foop.
It's a good word.
It's going spare. Let's take it.
There's one more ghost word that's kind of funny. It's the word morse, which obviously exists now to some extent. But in Sir Walter Scott's novel, The Monastery, there is a line that says, "Dost thou," well, originally it was thought to say, "Dost thou so soon morse thoughts of slaughter?" And footnotes were added. Like, people thought about this. They're like, what does morse mean?
Yeah, they really did.
Oh, right.
It comes from the Latin mordere, to bite.
Like, it was, the speculation was wild. And it, like, until much later, this was like 30 years before Samuel F.B. Morse became the source of the word Morse code. So it wasn't affiliated with that at all. So many people thought it meant like to prime, like one might prime a musket. And only when the original manuscript was found later was it found that he wrote nurse instead. Yeah. Nursing thoughts of slaughter.
Which makes so much more sense. If they'd just gone back and checked sooner, it's ridiculous. Oh, and we'll do one more ghost word just because it is relevant to today's subject. And that is phantom nation, which was considered a word meaning an apparition, sort of a cross between a phantom and an apparition. So I don't remember the precise wording of what it was defined as, but basically an apparition. But they realized that actually it was taken from Alexander Pope's translation of Homer, in which he wrote all the phantom nations of the dead. But he put a space between phantom and nation. The word phantom nation was taken from another writer who was obsessed with creating compound words. And so he invented phantom nation. He just smashed the two words together, and lo, was a new word created as lexicographers went, well, what could this possibly mean?
That's fantastic. I love it.
There you go. That's the spookiest ghost word, arguably.
speaking of phantom, while we're on that, I suppose we could transition into actual ghosts.
Oh, yeah. Right.
By actual ghosts, I mean, you know,
yeah, I mean,
to whatever extent ghosts are actual.
As they are. This one came up while I was just doing some research about the printing press, actually, the word ghost itself. But I'll let you go more into the history of the word itself, but do you know why there's an H in there?
I actually do, but I would like to hear it from you.
Well, do you know who's credited with inventing it, with putting the H in there?
Who's that?
William Caxton, the person responsible for the very first printed book in the English language and responsible for setting up the first printing press in the UK in Westminster. And he had spent a lot of his life in Belgium, particularly in Bruges, learning from the printers there. And in Dutch, the word ghost, not now, actually they say spook now, but the word ghost in Dutch back then, or in Flemish specifically, had an H in it. So he took that H and put it in. But if you look for citations of the word ghost from before the early 15th century, you do not find an H in it.
Mm-hmm. The same thing happened with the words aghast and ghastly, which share a root with ghost, but both of them are from an Old English word that means to frighten and does not contain an H.
Yeah, the word ghost is just like proper old Germanic. Far back as you can go, you find something along those words, along the lines of ghast, geist, geist, ghost. Poltergeist, there we go. That's
exactly.
Nod to the German word. Actually, that's got quite an interesting origin as well. Not interesting origin, but the word poltergeist rises to prominence with Martin Luther, the father of Protestantism, because in a document where he's listing the many evils of Catholicism, at number 5, he just puts the word poltergeists, noisy ghosts, as it means in German. And he's using it as a reference to literally ghosts. He does mean literally ghosts, but he feels that in the Catholic Church, they've broken the rule of Christianity that the only way you are supposed to be able to communicate with the dead is via angels sent by God. But Catholicism has invented all of these various extra cheats ways to get in touch with ghosts, or they've taught a doctrine whereby someone who you love will come back and haunt you if you don't say enough mass for them. So he sees this as one of the many corruptions of Catholicism, poltergeists.
Ghosts are, they weren't always necessarily scary either, too. Like the concept of a ghost, like the Old English verb ghasten means to frighten, but it literally means to gasp. And it's because ghast meant like breath, life, or spirit. And so these concepts are why we have like the Holy Ghost and the Holy Spirit and things like that. And they're quite a bit older than the idea of a ghost as an apparition of a deceased person, which is more like 14th century.
Yeah, I read some Old English and I remember it had the phrase gastigawarthat, which meant the Holy Ghost. It meant God.
And the same thing happened with the word spirit. The Latin spiritus, meaning breath, or more specifically like breath of a god, was translated into English as ghost. And now both are used as words for dead apparitions that you can see through for the most part.
That's wonderful. It's interesting how you see words follow the same root.
Absolutely.
Completely independently of one another.
Another type of specter, you might say, or a type of thing from beyond the grave, yeah, which I think has a cool apparition. Origin, is a ghoul, right?
Yeah, ghoul's a good one. Ghoul's a really good one, because I don't think people will expect where the word ghoul comes from.
It's an Arabic word.
Yeah.
It's from the Arabic word ghala, meaning to seize. The Arabic ghoul means a male ghoul, while a female ghoul is a ghula. Yeah.
It's quite specifically like a body-snatching ghost, right? The ghoul in Arabic. And that's why it's related to this word meaning to seize, because it's the idea of seizing the bodies of the living. Spooky. Spook, by the way, is just the Dutch word.
Yeah, right. Some of these words, like a lot of words for monsters, kind of were introduced into English via literature. Some of the ones that we come up with today, like ghoul came into English via a translation of William Beckford's novel Vathek, which was originally written in French. It was an Orientalist novel. It like imitated aspects of the Eastern world, kind of a little cultural appropriation-y. And it tells the story of Caliph Vathek, who renounces Islam and tries to gain supernatural powers through a series of terrible and licentious deeds like sex and drugs and human sacrifice. And so that's how English was introduced. But the idea of a ghoul is much older in Arabic and was very much like a a spirit known for robbing graves and consuming flesh.
And for any Brits watching, wondering where the word ghoulies might have come from, that actually comes from Hindi. It's a Hindi word for bullet. If anyone doesn't know what the word ghoulies meant, don't look it up. You don't need to know. It's testicles.
Of course it is.
You say that in the States. I feel like that must be a really British word.
Ghoulies. Yeah, that's not. Yeah. If I said that to mean testicles, no one would know what I meant. Exactly.
I remember I was in a pantomime one year, and a typical scene is going into a haunted cave, right? And I was one of the sort of comedy double act going into the haunted cave. One character says, "Oh, watch out for the ghosts and ghoulies." And the other one says, "I don't mind being grabbed by the ghosts, but I certainly don't want to be grabbed by the..." And then they get interrupted before they get around to the end of the sentence. It's a very naughty word. But yeah, from the Hindi word for bullets.
I love it. So another type of spirit that, and I love the origin of this word, is nightmare. Oh, do you know the origin of nightmare?
Yeah, I do, actually. But you go there, because I'm going to talk about some other language versions of that word.
Oh, I'd love that. So obviously, predictably, it has nothing to do with female horses. The mare in this is not a horse. In Old English, a mare was, in this case, that spelling of that word has several different meanings. But in this case, it's a word for a goblin or an incubus, which is the male version of a succubus, and probably comes from a root meaning to harm or to die or to like scrub someone from the face of the earth. All of these things are demons or monsters who visit people in the night and like sit on them, or like they give you night terrors. It may be an interpretation of someone having night terrors and imagining a thing sitting on their chest and preventing them from breathing, or maybe having a sex dream with them, because incubuses and succubuses are very much like people who visit, or people, monsters who visit you in the night to seduce you. But incubus and succubus replaced the Old English word mare in the mare in the 1600s in all uses except for the word nightmare. So it's sort of a fossil word.
Oh yeah, nice. Yeah, mm-hmm. Little fossil element. And that element finds its way into the French word as well. The French word for nightmare is cauchemar, which the cauch bit means to press. So you know you're talking about it being like, you know, coming in at night and sort of sitting on you. It's that oppressive feeling that you wake up with. That's where cauchemar in French comes from. It's a woman, I guess, that sits on you during the night. And you mentioned that this was kind of an impish demon. The German word for a nightmare is Albtraum, which means elf dream.
You know, that's why I think that this was probably like people experiencing night terrors or, you know, sleep paralysis demons, more or less, and you know, giving a word to them, which if you experienced that before that had ever been explained by science, that would be terrifying. I mean, it already is terrifying.
Have they ever been explained by science? That's the thing. Freaky stuff. And it's but you know, it's universal. And so you can feel a little bit better about it. You know, not the only one going through it. They're going through it in every language.
Right. Another ghostly word is haunt. And when we say, like, if you have an old haunt that you visit frequently, or you're using the original sense of the word haunt, like to haunt a scuola in Middle English meant to attend school frequently. So like it wasn't used in necessarily a creepy way, in the way that we tend to use haunt outside of the phrase, like your usual haunt today.
What other monsters can we cover here, Jess?
Let's see. Let's get into like the proper monsters, the ones that show up for the Monster Mash.
Yeah, the real showbiz ones, right? The big hitters, the A-listers. The vampires, perhaps?
Yes, let's do vampire. Though this one is like, the answer is sort of we don't know, but it has a bunch of cool stories about it too.
Yeah, exactly. The word vampire itself is actually sort of boring. We know it's a Slavonic word, maybe from Russian, but we're not really sure. Across the Slavic languages, you have very similar words. And as far as I can tell, they just mean vampire.
Right. The word is just words for vampire.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But that's a specific type of demon, I suppose. It's I think traditionally it is the spirit of a criminal who comes back to feast on the blood of the innocent, right, Jess?
And for a specific reason too. Like, so we know that English adopted the word. It's not originally from French or German, but it came to English via French and German literature, because during the 1720s, there was a vampire craze when two suspected vampires were exhumed in Serbia under the Habsburg monarchy and found to be supposedly very intact with blood on their mouths. So the thought was that they had climbed from the grave and were biting people and drinking blood.
And that started a whole hysteria around vampires.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
The first instance of vampire in English is in an anonymous manuscript called The Travels of Three Englishmen from Venice to Hamburg. It went unpublished until like 1745 when Samuel Johnson actually edited it into the Harleian Miscellany.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, spooky stuff. And who, dear Jess, is the most famous vampire?
Well, Dracula, of course.
Yeah. Where does he get his name then? Where did Bram Stoker get the name? Abraham Stoker, the writer of Dracula. Where did he get the name Dracula from?
So it's a Romanian name. It means son of Dracul or son of the dragon, which is cool. Of course, Bram Stoker popularized it in English as a name for a vampire. And he drew the name of his title character from Prince Vlad II of Wallachia, also known as Vlad the Impaler or Vlad Dracula, who was a real person probably kind of a scary dude.
Yeah, he did call himself Dracula, so far as we know. I mean, his dad was also Vlad Dracul. Well, no, Vlad the Impaler was Vlad Dracula, son of Vlad Dracul. And I think the dragon, one of the theories behind the dragon link is that Vlad Dracul was inducted into the Order of the Dragon group of Christian knights. Anyway, Vlad the Impaler was a dreadful, dreadful man, I think it's fair to say. And his preferred way of torturing and killing people was to stick them on a big old spike, hence the name, you know, until they died. But there are stories that he enjoyed dining among his victims and that he would dip his bread in their blood. And I think Bram Stoker thought, maybe he's the guy I should name this vampire after.
I've heard to what extent those stories are true is you know, kind of up in the air, like whether and to what extent have, but he certainly seemed to like let the legends take their course for the reputational gain on that front, which makes sense. I mean, you know.
I don't think he was a nice man. I think nevertheless, he wasn't a terribly, terribly nice man.
Uh-huh.
Another nice little tidbit is that Transylvania means beyond the forest. The Sylvanias are the same as you have in Pennsylvania, which basically means
And like Sylvan forest. Elves and things like that are forest elves.
Sylvanian families as well. Families of the forest. Actually, so it gets, because it's a rather more romantic thing to say that it means beyond the forest, which makes it kind of more mystical, but it literally means, I suppose, across the forest, like transatlantic.
On the other side. I would say that Dracula as a book is one of the funniest books I've ever read. I'm not going to go on my full rant here, but like the internal inconsistencies and the ninja cowboy in that book are hilarious. It's a comedy. I don't care what anyone says.
The ninja cowboy. Tell us about the ninja cowboy.
Quincy Morris is a Texan character in that book speaks hilariously like a Texan. And one of the reason I call him a ninja cowboy is because of the way that Stoker writes, sometimes he appears in a scene without him ever having been introduced before. Like he'll just say something and like at no point in the introduction to the scene did Stoker tell us that he was in the room. So it happens like two or three times.
They also don't really address why Dracula has decided he has to go and seek out a specific attractive woman in England when presumably in between Romania and England, there are plenty of others where he doesn't, for example, need to sit in a coffin in a ship.
It is full of plot holes. It is. And also Van Helsing, like in some points of the novel, he speaks very fluent English when it's useful for him to explain things. And then other times he speaks like really awkward pidgin English.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny. So Dracula comes out and then an unofficial film is made of it and it gets called Nosferatu instead.
Which they're remaking it, and I'm so excited.
Do you know what? Here in Berlin, they show it fairly regularly. They have a cinema that specializes in showing these kinds of films, and I plan to as soon as I plan to. Absolutely.
That's a bucket list thing for me. I would love to go see Nosferatu in Germany.
Nosferatu is one of those words. There are a couple of theories about where it came from. I think the best one is that it's from Romanian. There's a Romanian term, nesuferitu, which can mean the insufferable one.
Oh, no.
I think it's probably a little bit graver than that
Nosferatu.
Word. It's just, it's such a pest. What a nuisance this man is. This blood-sucking demon is getting on my nerves. But another theory is that it's from Greek nosophoros, meaning disease carrier.
Ooh, creepy.
We now know that actually, you know, sucking people's blood would be a very good way of transmitting disease, I thought. I'm not sure how much they knew that when this word was coined.
I mean, the thing about monsters is they're always reflections of like societal fears. So whether like it varies on the depending on the time period, but like a vampire can be concerns over like religious immorality and like because it involves like an exchange of bodily fluids. It can be like fear over like sex. It can be fear over disease, any number of things. It can also, in many cases in the past, including in Bram Stoker's work, it can be about anti-Semitism. So like all kinds of stuff going on there.
They are sort of products of their time, aren't they? And I think a surprising thing about the word werewolf is just how old that term is.
Right. What does were and werewolf mean?
Well, the leading theory and the one that you see everywhere is that it's from an old English word for man, and there are other Germanic words along those lines that mean man. So it means man wolf is the most likely explanation for it. Although there are some inconsistencies in like the way it's spelt that some lexicographers are like, I'm not so sure that quite works. I mean, why is there that extra E?
It would make sense though, wouldn't it?
I mean, it fits perfectly. It's exactly what the thing is. But I did find an alternative explanation if you're in the market for one. I found one from 1425 and it says, there beeth some wolves that eaten children and men, and they be called, or they be cleffed, it says, but I think it means called in this sense, werewolves, for men should beware of them.
This sounds too silly.
I don't like it either. Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Yeah, that's exactly this. That's like a modern internet explanation of where werewolves come from.
I like the man wolf explanation, and I'm sticking with that unless somebody else really shows me that it means beware.
That's where the smart money is.
Like where and wary are also like, they're old words too, and the spelling is quite a bit different. So I think that's suspect.
Yeah, I completely agree.
My favorite little thing here though is if it does indeed mean where, like man wolf, it doesn't mean werewolf, then that implies the existence of female werewolves. And the old English word for a woman was weef, or wife, the predecessor to wife. So a female werewolf would be a weef wolf.
A weef wolf?
A weef wolf.
Yeah. And you do see those two words juxtaposed to one another in old English manuscripts, were and weef. So yeah, keep an eye out for weef wolves. Weef wolves.
Wolf is a very old word as well. Like wolves had a very complicated relationship with Anglo-Saxons because they existed in, you know, what is modern day England at the time. And they were systematically hunted to extinction by the end of the 15th century.
Good.
I like wolves.
Well, they've been reintroducing them across Europe, you know. But a clue to just how old that word is the fact that it has this unusual plural where the F turns into a V, because that is a characteristic of Old English speech, because the plural of wolf in Old English is spelled W-U-L-F-A-S, but an F in Old English, if it appears in the middle of a word and is between two vowel sounds, or L in this case, it makes a V sound. So wolf becomes wolvas.
Ooh,
in
neat.
Old English plural. There are other examples of that. Knife.
Knives.
Mm-hmm. Knives.
It happens with words like calves and halves too.
Ultimately, I'm trying to get to the point again that werewolves are a product of their time, because as you said, wolves were a big problem for the old Anglo-Saxon, you'd have reckoned.
One more connection on wolf here. I know that, like, I say this because I have Beowulf behind me. It literally means bee wolf, and it's a kenning. It means bear, because it implies a big fluffy wolf who likes honey, which is bear. So Beowulf's name means bear, but literally Beowulf.
Funny that.
Yeah, you know, I'm more scared of bears, I think, than I am wolves.
Oh, I'm equally scared of both. I don't want either of them. I really don't. A single wolf, maybe I could give it a good old smack in the face, but they're so very rarely on their own. That's a problem with wolves.
I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but my bridal shower, or whatever you might call it, bridal party, bachelorette party. There we go.
My bachelorette. Hen-do, as we call it.
There we go, exactly. But it was at a wolf sanctuary.
That's magnificent.
And there's like a photo of a wolf just like hanging out by my head.
What activities does one do at the wolf sanctuary?
Well, you howl with the wolf and you feed the wolves treats and you hear them snap their jaws, which is very cool.
Yeah. My stag do was in Manchester. Monster. We haven't talked about the word monster itself.
Monster. Yes, let's talk about monster. A monster wasn't like a corporeal thing always. It kind of was, but the word meant like divine omen or a sign. And sometimes that sign was a big diseased animal that scared the crap out of people.
Yeah. And by the time it gets from, so the Latin, it comes from the Latin word meaning to warn, right, ultimately. But by the time it passes from French into English, it kind of means a sort of disfigured person. But before that, a bit further back in time in French, it means, well, marvel was one of the words that I saw used for it, but it's kind of a negative marvel, right? It's something awful.
Less wonder, more, ah!
Yeah, exactly.
But the Latin verb form that this comes from, monstrare, means to point out or to show. So like to say something as a monster is same as the word demonstrate, but a monster is something that you point at and go like, ah, what the hell is that thing?
Okay, so that's the same as the French word montrer, which means to show now. Right, yeah. Okay, it seemed like it should be linked to that, but I hadn't managed to get to it.
Somebody asked me one time on my TikTok channel, why is there a demon in Demonstrate? And I got so excited because I got to say there's not a demon in Demonstrate, but there is a monster in it.
Very good. Very good. Very good. Well, Jess, I fear the witching hour is close at hand.
Yes, we're running out of time, but we promise to frighten you again in the future with more spooky and monstrous words. So we hope you'll tune in next time and drop us a line with some of your favorite spooky stories. I love scary stories and I write them. So I would love to hear your most frightening tales. You can put those in the comments or email us at wordsunraveledpod@gmail.com.
Until next time, have sweet nightmares.
Ooh. Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at Geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.